rise to power and the intricacies of that. But then the conservatives could have technically, legally speaking, made a government without the Nazis, but felt that they needed to be invited into and Hitler made chancellor because of the populist support surrounding them. That was necessary for them to have a quote-unquote government, even though technically, on legal grounds, it was not necessary. And so I think that that's, again, all relating back to the fact that these are very deeply popular movements, but again, are also very historically situated movements. I'm trying to think about where to take us next, because there's so many little avenues we can go down with fascism. But you know what I will say also, too, is that you're listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm Hale, your host. Today we're doing an episode on fascism. And with me is Aaron, Kira, and Brandon. And yeah, enjoy the rest of the second half of the episode. So I wanted to talk a little bit about fascism and you know, the rhetoric versus the reality of fascism. And in particular, I wanted to touch on especially Nazism and where that went. Because as I kind of mentioned earlier, fascism was born in Italy, but it really lacked the dynamism that was necessary for it to become a fully totalitarian vision. And that was kind of found and instantiated in Germany. You know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Brandon, but I believe somewhere I read a quote from Arendt on totalitarianism, where she talked about Nazi Germany being the paradigm case of totalitarianism, just that it was, like, quote-unquote, strangled in the cradle. That it was, you know, it only lasted 12 years versus the Soviet Union, which lasted nearly a century. So it was quite a short-lived thing. But it was really, many people look at Nazism as the paradigm case of fascism because of the incredibly high level of commitment involved. The people involved in that movement really, really, really believed in what they were doing. Whether they were fully aware of what they believed, because it's so, like, unclear, is one thing. And that's where the propaganda, as Brandon, comes in. You know, it's questions about race, fighting Bolshevism, fighting Jews, whatever it might be. Obviously, all the discussions on the Treaty of Versailles, post-World War I, all that kind of stuff. But fascists had very little to say about what they would actually do with power, what they would actually create. It was generally very vague platitudes around, you know, like we talked about already, rejuvenating the nation. But what actually happened, and what some people have brought up, including some well-known philosophers, is particularly in Nazi Germany, is this kind of meeting of aesthetics and power. Nazism in particular was, this is a little bit controversial, but in particular was an aesthetic movement. It was a movement of symbols, of style, of showmanship, very loud, very in your face. As Hitler himself said, the psyche of the great masses is not receptive to anything that is half-hearted and weak. And the Nazis really imbibed that statement, you know, with the rallies and the uniforms and the speeches and the propaganda. And it's important to remember that, in unlike Italy and many other even dictatorships, they had 100% control over media. So whether that be print, film, music, the Nazis absolutely invaded and took over every component of society. In Nazi Germany, you were not allowed to have a club that was not associated with the party. Everything had to be in line with the Nazi state. And that's where that totalitarian and total vision comes in, and why Arendt herself thought that it was perhaps the most intense case of totalitarianism.
So yeah, I think that's a very important point worth making about fascist states, is that not just the aestheticization, but there's a kind of complete running through of the party throughout the entire life of the state. It runs top to bottom, from the most public to private matters. There's a particular case that Arendt has in her book where she's talking about, and this is making a general point too, it's not just about particular institutions or whatnot, you're talking about clubs. She brings up chess clubs. You couldn't just have a chess club, but the philosophical point behind that is because the end of a chess club is itself, right? Like, when you go to a chess club, why do you go play chess? Well, you just go to do it for its own sake. But the point is that in a fascist state, nothing can be for its own sake. Everything has to be for the sake of something else. Usually, you know, the party cause or whatever they're getting up to at the time. So You can't have activity that is independent of the state, because the whole point of the fascist state is it one perpetual activity. And this goes back to the point you were making, and I think this is, it's a point that Arendt really stresses, is that, because you said they weren't super clear about what their goals were, or if they did articulate them, they were like very vague. That's a, as we might say, a feature, not a bug, because stability is the worst enemy of this. I think to, because you said Mussolini didn't really exemplify a, like he, the Nazis might say he rigidified in a way, his state came to a standstill and it became the fascist state of Italy. But for the Nazis, the whole point is to continuously keep this machine in motion, to always be expanding it, to never reach some point where you can say, okay, like this is the government, because the main, one of the points that Arendt makes is that then you would just be another state. You would be another state with laws and a political tradition and a people, and you'd have to go to their conventions and it'd be really boring and bad. The whole point is to evade this durability. Yeah, it's, the whole point is to evade the durability necessary for a state that can cooperate with other states. The whole point is to always kind of be up in the air, never settled on anything, because what you're trying to do is incorporate as much as you can. And you do that just by having this immediate goal that you don't really tell anyone is going on. And that's why you have an obscuring secret reality. You don't want to stop. You don't want to rigidify.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point. And it reminds me specifically of the historian Richard J. Evans, who's very well known for his series on the Third Reich, specifically talking about the dynamism of Nazism. We could say the dynamism of fascism. Again, talking about that aesthetic point, I don't think we can emphasize that enough for our listeners, that rather than a clear, coherent, solid political ideology, fascism is about movement. It's about dynamism. It's about action. It's about, a lot of times, it's about literally attack, right? Attack your internal enemies, attack the external enemies, right? The action, in a way, is the end. Like, obviously, there's an ostensible end that is talked about. You know, Hitler talked a lot of specifically about a 10,000-year Reich. Mussolini talked about, like, a new Rome and empire, all this kind of stuff. But all this sort of stuff is exceptionally vague and kind of weird and, like, unclear. Like, what are you even talking about? And completely unrealistic, too. neither of those nations had the populations or the capacity to, like, reach their penultimate goals. Like, that's just, like, was, like, just not going to happen. But that didn't really matter. Because what actually mattered, what the real point was the events taking place there and now. The action, the often violent actions taken by the individuals who were in power, and an extension of that, galvanizing the general population to support and be enthusiastic for those actions, right? And this is why it's interesting really to read some like letters and accounts from people actually living through that time or looking back on it, people who were, did actually consider themselves Nazis and stuff like that, because often they talk about it being very exciting is one of the main things that comes up, that they are in the midst of something very like quote unquote important. What that is, what that was happening, again, usually reverts in their own writings to a kind of vague greatness for Germany and the people, and look what we're doing. It's very unclear a lot of the time. But the point is that the excitement of the action, right? And then, as we've talked about before, I hate to keep harping on the aesthetics, but especially Nazi Germany, the action is also displayed in various kinds of style, right? Being deeply symbolic is also an action. It's a kind of activity. And purposefully doing that and doing that constantly, never stopping that, is essential. Because as Brandon pointed out, like in fascism, like it's kind of silly, especially talking about ideologies that resulted in the deaths of so many people. But they're such bad ideologies that, and I don't mean bad just as being immoral. I mean bad in terms of like they don't make any sense, that you can't have people stop and think about them. You can't have people pause. You can't have people allow to associate in ways that aren't within the movement, because you might look behind the veil effectively. And they were like fully aware of that in their own kind of weird way. I think that for us, especially in today's world and with our own current political ideologies, it's kind of a difficult thing to grasp because we live in an era and a time that's so focused on our individual needs and how each of us is doing within like the general system that we operate in, that we don't really think about the national state or the racial consciousness. I mean, I'm kind of glad we don't think about the racial consciousness, but like those sorts of terms and stuff were things that were thrown around a lot almost 100 years ago and were fundamental to this kind of idea that, you know, individual people don't matter so much. What matters is this large conceptual mass. And if that can be successful in some way, whatever that success means, really, then that's what's most important. And it also, I think, in particular, leads to the obviously deeply unethical nature of fascism, in that, you know, when you have a movement that doesn't really have any clearly defined structures or has barely any, and it's particularly an ideology that can subordinate itself to some vague overarching goal, like, you know, the health of the race, then you can pretty much justify anything you want to in terms of achieving that goal.
This show has been very interesting. It's definitely raised the bar, just because I think that both of you have really deeply engaged with the ideas that we're talking about today. And I do think it's very important just to take a moment and consider the depth and the magnitude of what we're talking about, which is the philosophy and the ideas of a political ideology that devastated the entire world, that led to hardships beyond description. I remember when in high school we had to read the book Night by Elie Wiesel, which talks about the horrors of the Holocaust. And I have to admit, as a high school student, that shook me in a way that nothing else has, and I don't think anything else ever will. And I know that this is a dark topic, but I think it's also very, very important, because at the base of philosophy, we have some ideas from all the way back of Plato warning us against like the danger of democracy, against the masses, against letting the masses unchecked guide society. And I think that that is somewhat exemplified in fascism. But I also think that Plato is wrong. I think that democracy can work and that doesn't have to be the case. And I think that it's our obligation to make sure that happens.
So I'm just going to put my two cents in here. It's a very large topic, but to kind of dumb it down for everyone as well, like I think there's lots of really interesting ways to look at fascism. And the easiest way, I think, to relate to it is the fact that all politics, I guess, are rooted in a system from religion or control and power over the masses. And so I think a lot of the ideologies that have come up in the past have been based on the fact that people, particularly one person at this point, desired power. I consider him to be, you know, like the gross bro dude of the world, you know, like just was in his own selfish interests and didn't care about anybody else. And in that way, but it was more about excelling in power, like with eugenics and all of, like, you have to remember like the existential racism that happened throughout it. And that, like it's so easy to kind of talk about like the government and like how much this other was, but like really the main part of this really was to wipe out the people that did not belong, you know, and with that was to make something perfect. So like, hey, like when you're saying like, you know, like with a new horizon, or, you know, it's kind of like this, even though it's like seems like a contradiction, it's not in the eyes of Hitler when he's thinking that if I make everything perfect, an OCD man, you know, makes everything perfect, then the world will be perfect and we'll have better in the future, right? Because like, if you look at science and everything, there's always a reason for it, you know, and especially at this time in the world, like this is where science is really coming about to be something that we all concretely know about. And with power also becomes military and wanting to gain power with that as well, right? So for me, it's just, it's this horrible incident where racism got extreme, where, you know, people from Black societies, from Africa, can understand this just in because it was in the same way you're treated as nothing, you know, you like in slavery, you know, people were treated as less than human. Women, we were treated, you know, less than man, you know, and it's this really horrible time across the world where there was just a lot of racism going on, and somebody had the ability to take power of a country and do some very horrible things. And it's still to this day, because people, like, it's their own selfish desire to want power, right? So that's why even still to this day, we have 1 in 10 people that are anti-Semitism, right? And it's just like, this is something that it's not just in a time and place, even though it seems like it. It's just it's a beginning and also a middle and an end, you know? But I guess, like, that's my 2 cents. And just to kind of, like, dumb it down in my own way for all the other listeners that are like, what? You know? And I really appreciate the depth and knowledge.
Thanks so much, both of you. And I think that you know, both of you were highlighting a point that is really important and can't be ignored. And that's obviously the racist component, right? Like, if you're talking about fascism, you can't really ignore what happened and where that came from. I think that this is actually one of, like, as we come to the, you know, our last 10 minutes or so, or whatever it might be, of the show, I think this might be an important point to kind of touch on, which is that in a lot of current studies of fascism, there's a lot of controversy around whether or not Nazism and fascism are the same thing, or whether or not Nazism is a distinct ideology. And the reason that people have concerns about that is that, well, both are ultra-nationalistic. Actually, like, you can reconstitute Nazism as being ultra-racialistic. You know, some people have said that, some scholars have said that, you know, Hitler didn't really care about the German nation or the German state, right? State apparatus, the borders, all that kind of stuff. Even notions of blood and soil, you know, the soil component, and sorry for our listeners, blood and soil is a very, like, well-known fascist term for sort of rooting whatever national body you're talking about, in their kind of place and historical origin, right? The soil that they till, this is a kind of classic fascist motif, that the reason a certain ethnic group is, or a certain national group is, you know, rightly within their said group, is because they or their ancestors tilled the soil for centuries or eons or whatever. It doesn't really make any sense. But, like, that was, like, one of their kind of arguments and, like, motifs that they often use, the blood and soil discussion. But for Hitler in particular, it was really about blood, that there was some sort of, like, genetic component to being German, that that was all that mattered. It didn't really matter where in the world you were. It didn't really matter what the borders were. The state was actually an annoyance. The state was, like, a thing to be overcome or used and thrown away at will. And that race is all that matters. This is a little bit different from Italian fascism, which was more traditionally nationalistic, right? Like, who was an Italian was kind of more who said they were an Italian, who kind of roughly looked Italian. Did you speak Italian? But there was a lot of variation there. And with Nazism, you get this advent that there's this kind of genetic component, that there's this, and as Kira pointed out, this sort of reliance on science, and I actually am going to use the term pseudoscience, because eugenics and all that is not real science, but Hitler and the Nazis thought of themselves as being deeply scientific with their movement, that their movement was well-studied, well-related to actual phenomena, that race and the sort of genetic genealogies they're talking about were very much a real thing, and the differences between races were very much a real thing, and that this social Darwinianism justified whatever they were going to do, right? And it also led them to think of other people, in particular individuals who they deemed to be Jewish, along with other groups such as Roma, Eastern European, various Slavic groups, all that kind of stuff, as being effectively parasitic, that they were not actually human, that they were some sort of other, well, they were human, but, like, an offshoot of humans that was, like, distant related to Germans, and that wasn't really a thing, and that they were actually trying to you know, dilute Germanness and take over the world themselves and all this kind of thing. And so that's really important to note, because that is the divergence that eventually leads in effectively into the Holocaust and the other crimes committed against a very large number of various ethnic groups and also social groups and people who identify in various different ways for the Nazis themselves. And so I think it's really important to mention that is really where that comes from. And that's also why there's so much controversy around, well, is fascism and Nazism the same thing, or do we actually have to have two distinct ideologies? As like we come to that, I want to say that I agree with the most popular decision on this point, which is that Nazism is just a kind of form of fascism, that it has all the key hallmarks that Italian fascism had as well. It just had this racial component that makes it kind of its own brand, but that especially, again, coming back to it, that sort of aesthetic, experiential component of fascism, about it not really being a thought out, clear, bulwark ideology, about it not being, and this is something we haven't talked about as much, I wish we would talk a little bit more, that it's, you know, Marxism and neoliberalism, various forms of capitalism, are distinctly economic ideologies. These are ideologies that have put economics at the center of, you know, their framework. This is not the case with fascism. And this is what makes it so difficult, I think, for a lot of us to understand it, is economics is simply a tool for the nation or the race. So whether or not you have right-wing economic policies, whether or not you have left-wing economic policies and the views of other peoples and other states throughout the world, it doesn't matter. Like, they don't really care. Is it sometimes better to talk about private property and how important private property is? Sure, Hitler talked about it all the time. Did they also have massive state-owned corporations in Nazi Germany? They absolutely did. And this is where a lot of confusion comes in today, even so, where people will utilize fascism for their own political purposes, not the actual ideology, but more or less the term, to throw as a pejorative. And they'll say that, oh, did you know that the fascists are actually liberal, that they're left-wing, that, you know, therefore left-wing people are bad, or that they were obviously right-wing, and so therefore the right-wing people are, you know, you're closer to fascism than I am. And the point is that fascism jumps around on the spectrum. It takes what it needs and it leaves the rest whenever it needs to, because it's not about having a hardcore solidified ideology. It's about the movement. It's about the attack. It's about where you're going and that process of going there, rather than any particular, you know, thought out theory, which makes it super weird. And in some ways, honestly, makes it very interesting to try and understand and study. But it makes it very unique in the historical political landscape.
Yeah, the failure of, Arendt says, the failure of, you know, liberal kind of ideology to understand this is really, it's not really a function of left or right, it's a function of the fascist movement itself. I think of it as like, if we have this very simple left and right political spectrum, it's like, fascism is like a fork that stabs itself through it. And not to like get some bias, I mean, some violent imagery or anything, but the way it kind of appears on it, it doesn't work. It doesn't pop up. It pops up in all kinds of different weird arbitrary places, but that's because it doesn't work on a spectrum. It's of a totally radically different nature. It doesn't, whole its constancy is not held together by reality. It is held together by ideologies, self-sustaining ideologies that are the engine for the fantasy of an unlimited goal, like pure political movement. Arendt wouldn't call it political at all, because it forecloses upon the ability to interact with people, but that's what makes it so radically different. This is not a political theory that has ever really played within the rules before. This is something working from different fundamental political principles. How can we construct a state in which no one can actually politically act, where there is no capacity for people coming together, where everyone is massed together in their total isolation. That's not political action at all. We don't decide anything. You just appeal to the will of a leader, which was probably not their will anyway, in the service of a word with a capital letter, basically.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, as we end the show, it's perhaps something for all of us to think about. I really like how you said that there, Brandon, that, you know, part of what perhaps, you know, this movement that we're talking about, this ideology, fascism, you know, why is it so popular, right? And unfortunately, why does it still galvanize people today, right? Like, why are there still people out there who have some kind of fascist aspirations or inspirations or whatever? And I think, you know, as both you and I are talking about, it comes down to the fact that it is incredibly unique and energetic. It does not stop to parse out details and try and, you know, figure things out and come to debate, right? It is a movement that is all about, I've said this before for listeners, but all about action, right? All about movement, all about attack. And that makes it very, very unique. And I also think that it makes it very enticing for people who feel stuck or betrayed by their current world and their current situation. As people did in, you know, post-World War I Italy and in 1930s Germany, people felt betrayed, people felt hurt, people felt broken, you know, and kind of like a fight or flight response. Many people decided to fight. And it wasn't particularly, but that was where they thought they were at and what they needed to do, at least some of them. And that was taken advantage of by a very particular kind of ideology. But with that, I know we're running out of time. So I want to thank you all for listening to our show on fascism. And see you next time. We enjoyed the episode and hope you'll join us again for the Canadian Philosophy Show.
The Canadian Philosophy Show is now available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. Go ahead and check out our archives. Just search for The Canadian Philosophy Show and we should show up.